families. I'm Rebecca Zimmerman. A recent study by the research group Child Trends found that children in Arkansas are more likely to have an adverse childhood experience than children in any other state, making adverse childhood experiences a major public health issue for Arkansas. From stress caused by poverty to trauma caused by witnessing a parent's drug abuse, adverse childhood experiences can have a significant impact on a child's overall well-being. Today, we will discuss what adverse childhood experiences are, what treatment options are available, and what public policy can address the issue. We are joined by four guests: Janie Ginocchio with Arkansas Foundation for Medical Care, Marquita Little with Arkansas Advocates for Children and Families, Dr. Alan Meese with the Department of Health, Dr. Chad Rogers with the Little Rock Pediatric Clinic and Arkansas Foundation for Medical Care. And before we get started with that, I just want to let everyone know who's listening that has Medicaid or knows someone who has Medicaid to stay tuned for the end of the show, because we will be discussing the new work requirements for Medicaid and how you can make sure that you keep your coverage. But let's get started with introductions. Dr. Meese, do you want to talk about your work and a little bit about yourself?
I'm Dr. Alan Meese. I'm the Medical Director for Child and Adolescent Health at the Arkansas Department of Health, and I'm relatively new to Arkansas. I practice pediatrics many places, and my work focuses on improving the health of all children and adolescents in Arkansas. And one of our root problems for poor health in children, as well as throughout the life course, is early life adversity and toxic stress and its impact on the developing brain.
Hi, I'm Janie Ginocchio. I'm lead policy and program analyst for the Arkansas Foundation for Medical Care. We're a 46-year-old nonprofit organization that has offices here in Little Rock and Fort Smith, and traditionally we work with healthcare providers from physicians to hospitals to nursing homes and so forth, to help them improve the quality of care that they deliver and also assist them with Medicaid and Medicare policy. In my role here at AFMC, I'm the coordinator for the Arkansas Adverse Childhood Experiences and Resilience Work Group, which is a work group that has about 230 individual members that represent about 100 organizations and agencies here in the state.
And I'm Chad Rogers. I, as usual, kind of wear many hats, but as Janie just spoke about AFMC, I serve as their corporate medical officer, and so get to oversee a lot of the medical aspects of AFMC and the programs that we implement, and have had the pleasure of working with her on the Adverse Childhood Experiences work group. I also work as a general pediatrician here in Little Rock as a doctor for kids. I've been practicing for over 15 years. In my experience, I've spent a lot of time doing child advocacy, and have also served on the board for the Arkansas Advocates for Children and Families, and then spent some other time as the chapter president for the American Academy of Pediatrics. So my focus has largely been on children, but I think in this discussion, we need to remember that when we raise healthy children, we raise healthy adults, and I think this also greatly impacts the adult Arkansans we have here.
Hi, I'm Marquita Little. I'm the Health Policy Director at Arkansas Advocates for Children and Families, and I also serve on the ACES work group, as well as the subgroup that's looking at policy issues. A lot of our work at AACF, as well as I think our role really in being a part of the ACES conversation, is certainly about identifying ways that we can ensure children have safe, healthy, early starts, but also really working to identify policy opportunities to ensure that that actually happens. How can we align our policies in this state to ensure that children and their families have what they need?
And I just want to get started by explaining more about what adverse childhood experiences are.
Right. I think you hear a lot about ACEs, I think is a common term a lot of people are using that represents adverse childhood experiences. You also hear people talk about childhood trauma and toxic stress, which are all similar topics. But I think a lot of times when people think of childhood trauma, they think of like physical trauma. And really, we're looking at the effects of adverse childhood experiences, which can be physical, things that you would traditionally think is child abuse and neglect. But it can also be emotional. So maybe, verbal abuse by a parent, sexual abuse, and then you have some household dysfunction. A parent may have been incarcerated. The parents are separated, or the child doesn't have two kind of supporting adults in their life that sort of help make sure that they can withstand stress. We know that stress in itself is just a natural part of life, but there's sometimes when kids are not given the resources they need in order to deal with stress and respond to stress in an appropriate way. And sometimes that stress is so severe that their body just sort of goes into overdrive. We've all had that experience where we've been in a bad accident or something, or we have been frightened by something, and your heart rate increases and you get sweaty and you have this, got to get ready to either fight or flight response is what they call it. But these kids who live environments where they're constantly exposed to toxic stress and these adverse childhood experiences and can't get away from them and don't have good adaptive behaviors or good, adult support to help them do this, they have this long-term exposure. We have an just a great amount of evidence that's sort of growing that shows the impact of that on, particularly on the developing brain, especially in those critical years, those first couple of years of life when kids are developing, but also a long-term on all the organs of their body and their immune system and everything else. So we really have, because of all the recent research and everything, there seems to be this overwhelming, increasing interest in this topic.
And I'd also like to add that further research has added to the original 10 ACEs that we normally talk about to include exposure to community violence, systemic racial discrimination or bias, poverty, traumatic grief, such as losing a caregiver to death or being separated from siblings or being placed in the foster care system, and then within that, multiple placements within foster care as well.
I think the ACEs is sort of the negative side of the coin, and what we know that we need to emphasize at the front end is resilience. And you can't prevent all adversity and all bad things from happening, but what you can do is understand that you can protect the child from the negative effects of ACEs by positive, supportive, nurturing relationships. But when there's adversity and no supporting relationships is when the effects are particularly long-term and catastrophic.
So, I mean, it does sound like there are a lot of things that could lead to adverse or are adverse childhood experiences. And at the top of the show, I quote a report I saw that from Child Trends that Arkansas, children in Arkansas are more likely than children in any other state to experience adverse child experiences. Why do you think that is? Why are we so high? And how many children does that actually end up being in the state that do have adverse child experiences?
I will start this because I'm relatively new to Arkansas. So I was kind of very surprised that in last year's study, which is the one you quoted, Arkansas is the highest among states for the prevalence of two or more adverse childhood experiences. And that amounts to a significant number of kids. And the question is why? And that's what you're asking. And we can talk a little bit about the whys. But the fact that it impacts a number of kids is profound. And it impacts, therefore, the life course health development over time. And this is why Arkansas also has high problems with cancer, heart disease, mental illness, and other issues throughout the lifespan. So Janie's got some specific numbers in translating the percentages, so I'll let her talk to that.
So according to the 2016 National Survey of Children's Health, which is where Child's Trends got their information, 55.9% of Arkansas children have experienced at least one ACE. And so that translates based on, if you do the math from the kids count under 18 population numbers, which is 705,053 children under the age of 18 in 2016 here in Arkansas. So that translates to 394,000 children who've experienced at least one childhood adversity. So when you look at the breakdowns for that, 27% of children have experienced at least one, or have experienced one, 13% have experienced two, and 16% have experienced 3 to 8. And so that translates to about 112,000 children that have experienced 3 to 8 ACEs here in the state. So When you look at the behavioral risk factor surveillance system that the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention does, they do a telephone survey every year of adults, and the health department did the ACEs module or set of questions for adverse childhood experiences in 2016, and that result came out as 60% of adults in the state have experienced at least one adverse childhood experience. And so when you look at the individual measures, you can see where this happens. So we are double the national average at 19% for children who have had at least one caregiver or parent who has been incarcerated or in jail. We have high rates of postpartum depression. We have high rates of extreme poverty. When you look at that, you can kind of see where the case gets built for these adverse childhood experiences being so high here in the state. And then it becomes a chicken and egg thing, because we know that these adversities are intergenerational and they repeat from generation to generation if there's not anyone coming in or helping the family break that cycle. So.
Well, I think I want to go back to a little bit to what Janie sort of talked about, you know, just sort of the generational poverty and also the generational racism that we've experienced here in the South, and just that, you know, we have grandparents and parents and they're traumatized. And unfortunately, it almost is sometimes a state of normalcy, some of the things that happen, and we don't know. But we do know that we parent the way we were parented, and how that these things can deeply affect the way that we raise our children.
I think the other important thing for parents is, as Dr. Rogers mentioned, we parent like we were parented. And where do we learn parenting in our society? Nowhere. We learn from how we were parented, and there's nothing to mitigate that. So it does go from generation to generation. And we now have more science to help us understand the things we should be doing as parents that can be positive and supportive of children. And some of the ways of thinking in the past, really, not only are they not helpful, they are a hindrance and contribute to the ACEs. So I think its role in parenting is a very profound role.
And you're listening to Speak Up Arkansas, and we are talking about adverse childhood experiences. And if you want to give us a call, the number is 501-433-0088. And for all the children who do receive or do have adverse childhood experiences, how do you screen for those? And I guess how many children aren't being screened?
Right. I think I'm going to let Alan talk about this and Dr. Meese talk about this as well. You know, really, I think as a pediatrician, you know, we've always sort of been aware of the impact of social issues on child and parent well-being. I think there's many ways in which, you know, physicians often, when they're talking to a family, not only do you talk about family history, but you often do what's called a social history, where you ask things. But I think we haven't been asking the right questions, and we haven't done it in a way in which, you know, people don't feel threatened. And then I think there's, and now we know, you know, what are the issues? What are the things that we need to be looking at? So I would say currently there are some people around the country, and that's what I want Dr. Meese to talk about, that are looking at ways to do this. But I would say very few children are getting well screened here in the state.
Yeah, there's some, this is, you have to keep in mind, this is relatively a new thing.
Mm-hmm.
And the science is evolving rapidly every month. So we are learning the connection between how these experiences affect the stress system on a developing child and what the long-term implications are. And so recognizing the need to screen is, I think, something that we are in the process of doing as a medical community. Traditionally, doctors stay in the doctor biomedical lane and stay out of the biopsychosocial lane to some degree. But we have to change that, because we know that in this case, the adversity, the sociology, the environment becomes the biology that has lifelong implications. One of the forefront practices in the U.S. is Dr. Nadine Burke-Harris, who's written a great book called The Deepest Well. I'd highly recommend it. It talks about her experience of a practice in a challenging area, and basically how she instituted screening. And we are beginning to discuss this as a pediatric community and the local chapter of the AAP, with Chad's help, and through some of our venues at the Children's Hospital, beginning to talk about this and recognize that we really need to do this. As a pediatrician, I practiced many years, a few more than Chad. I wouldn't want to admit how many years, but I would tell you if I'm, and I don't see patients every day anymore, but if I was seeing a patient today, the first thing I'd want to know is what the mother's history was, because her history of childhood adversity, not in an attributional way, but will help inform how we can better support that mother mm-hmm. and provide her the parenting support, not just education, but support that she might need to do a better job to protect her children and break the cycle.
And one of the areas that we've done a lot of work on, too, over the last year, and Arkansas Advocates, along with a couple of partners, Arkansas Children's Hospital, Campaign for Grade Level Reading, and a Natural Wonders Partnership Council, is really focusing a lot on those early screenings. So we know that in Arkansas, when compared to other states or even the national average, we kind of lag behind on children getting regular access to a screen. And, you know, it's some of the common barriers. So some of those same things that are a result of a family living in poverty, maybe the parent doesn't have a job where they can take time off to take their child to even regularly see their physician. You know, maybe there are transportation barriers. And that's just a part of the equation, because as Dr. Meese mentioned, that may just be sort of a regular visit where they're really looking at some of the medical issues. And so that next layer then is what types of screens children should be getting in addition to where. So, you know, one area where we've been working is trying to figure out if there's other settings where children can be screened. So in their early childhood setting in a daycare center. But then the other piece is what should be included in that screen. In the great example that you mentioned, Dr. Meese, the Children's Hospital and their work with on the medical legal partnership, they are really screening children as they come into their clinics for some of those other risk factors and trying to address kind of the needs of the whole family and the whole child.
And I guess that makes me think of, so the doctors here, would you recommend that every child be screened for adverse childhood experiences? And if not, or if so, what signs should parents and teachers and pre-K providers be looking for to know that there might be a problem?
Yeah, you know, I think a lot of the times you go to the doctor, there's many things, you know, that you want to accomplish. I think there's a real push towards encouraging physicians to use standardized tools for screening so that the people are not missed. We often think that in the course of the conversation of that 10 or 20 minute visit that we capture everything, but there's a lot that is missed and there's a lot of missed opportunity. I think the American Academy of Pediatrics definitely recommends regular developmental screening to identify early developmental delays. A lot of those children are very high at risk having adverse childhood experiences. Some of it too, Dr. Meese and I were talking about this earlier, you know, when you do an ACE screen, you're not necessarily trying to diagnose something, you're just trying to get some history and learn kind of where the patient's coming from. I think this whole thing, especially for me in my practice, has been very eye-opening. You see a lot of families that come in and, you know, sometimes the parents can be unengaged, or sometimes they can be sort of hyper-vigilant if they don't think they're being treated well. Many times the children are very hyperactive and jumping around the room and constantly jumping on off the bed, the exam table, the bed that they sit on. Or they come because the school has sent them in out because they're, quote, a bad kid. What a lot of these are actually just what we call adaptive behaviors. They've lived in this constant state of stress, so they've had to figure out some way to adapt and respond, and they didn't learn how to do it appropriately, how to bring their emotions down and how to calm and self-soothe and kind of, kind of de-escalate. I think a lot of times, you know, I have to think children come in with things like sleep problems. And could that be because they go home and all night long, you know, there's, you know, police cars going by and there's shootings and the parents are arguing, or maybe, you know, one of the parents is intoxicated. Yeah, have a lot of kids who come in with this chronic belly pain and you've worked them up from stem to stern, you know, you've done x-rays and labs and you can find no reason for their belly ache. I think also, Dr. Meese may want to speak more to this as well. We talked about, you know, there's a lot of kids getting diagnosed with ADHD, and it's probably just these kids that are sort of in a hyper state of arousal where they're just constantly, that fight or flight response is in a constant state because of the chaotic and stressful environments that they live in.
certainly a child may present at any age, and this is part of our challenge, because society tends to think of kids as not being affected. They won't remember anything, and that's true. Their memory is not, their explicit memory to remember events when you're younger than three almost doesn't exist, but it becomes part of your biology, and it becomes part of your stress response. And so a baby, an infant, may present with failure to thrive, not doing well. Typical problems babies have: crying all the time, sleeping all the time, or not sleeping all the time, I should say. Opposite of sleeping all the time, not sleeping enough. Other problems that are behavioral in nature. So one of the things that we are recognizing, as we recognize the issues earlier, we have to have new ways to intervene. And there are therapies that are effective, but not all therapists know these therapies. Example being child-parent psychotherapy. You can't treat the baby by himself, herself. You got to treat the mother and baby as a dyad. Problems with breastfeeding. Breastfeeding, we all know, is the best way to go, but why don't mothers breastfeed? Because they have their own issues that they're dealing with and don't have the emotional bandwidth to do it. So another age, ADHD is a good, there is such a thing as ADHD, but a lot of it is overdiagnosed. Asthma, worsening of asthma is another indicator of an older child that might have problems. Any behavioral problems. Kids getting thrown out of preschool, particularly boys, for aggressive behavior. And then as you get older, you get into teen behavior, bullying, and school issues that are profound, that have roots all the way back to early life adversity.
Speaking of someone with lived experience, I personally have an ACE score of 6. I would advocate for every child, because sometimes these things happen under in silence, in the home. They're not talked about. And so even a child that doesn't necessarily have any major issues or problems may be experiencing those things, but they found a way to adapt or to cope that is more in line with what normal behavior would be. And so they fly under the radar. And so if you don't screen that child and ask those questions, you may never know what's going on with them.
Certainly that's true, that not all the children have specific symptoms. I think the other thing is that if you screen the parents and their ACE score, that's helpful. But then as far as screening the child, the best tool that Dr. Burke Harris has developed is the de-identified ACEs, which is, here's a list of things. How many of these things are happening to your child? So you avoid the issues of reportability of some of the more serious issues, and it opens the conversation, the dialogue with the mother about what is really going on.
And I think, we've been kind of focused on some of the effects on children, but I think one of the reasons that the ACE work is so interesting is the impact it has had on adults and in our teenagers. I think, you see very early on kids dealing with chronic stress, they have to find some way to deal with them. So you see drug use among teens, or you see the teens that are running away for various reasons. But I think it's really interesting to know about sort of the impact on long-term healthcare. And I know that's a lot of the area that Janie has worked on.
So in the original ACEs study that was published in the mid-1990s, what they did was they took 17,000 Kaiser Permanente health plan enrollees, and they asked them 10 questions regarding things that happened to them when they were before the age of 18. So, and they fell into three categories of abuse, neglect, and household dysfunction. And for every positive response to those 10 questions, you got 1 point. And so you could have an ACE score of 0 to 10, which is the measure that we've been talking about as far as the recent surveys and everything. And so then they went back and they took those ACE scores and linked them to the individual's health claims. And what they found is a very strong correlation between the number of ACEs you have and negative health outcomes. And so, for example, if you are a male who has an ACE score of 6 or more, you are 46 times more likely to become an IV drug user. If you have an ACE score of 6 or more, you are more likely to die 20 years before someone of a similar age that doesn't have any ACEs. Other things, you're 12.2 times more likely to commit suicide if you have more than four ACEs. You're 4.2 times more likely to develop Alzheimer's. So there's a lot of linkages between your early adversity and long-term health and well-being. So higher incidences of mental health issues, of substance abuse, of suicide, of chronic disease, obesity, heart disease, all of those things that we've been fighting against in health and healthcare for years now.
And all of which Arkansas's numbers are on the high side. So this correlates certainly with what we now know about the prevalence of ACEs. And we talk about at the health department, the common problems, obesity, the opioid crisis, school violence, all the things that are in the news, violence against women, you know, because a child seeing his mother beat up is extremely difficult situation. And then we talk about incarceration. And that's one of the highest. Arkansas has a high rate of incarceration. So,
you're listening to Speak Up Arkansas. We're talking about adverse childhood experiences. And if you have a question, you can give us a call at 433-0088. And all of what y'all just said is pretty disturbing. And I guess my question, Dr. Meese, you said that we parent how we were parented. How can parents break the cycle and adopt better parenting techniques, and what treatment options are available for these children so it doesn't have long-term effects? And I'm hoping that there is an answer to that that y'all have.
Well, you know, I'm just going to say, as a pediatrician, I realized a long time ago that we're never going to be able to solve all the things that that would make our children be healthy, that's healthier homes, healthier schools, healthier communities. So it's, you know, certainly I think a lot of people look to their pediatrician for parenting and advice, but I think, you know, and certainly pediatricians are trained to give advice, but I think there's a lot of role modeling. I think there's a lot of community support, and it's not just a message that happens in one place, but it's a message that happens in multiple places. It happens at church. It happens at school. It happens when you're picking up and dropping off your kids from daycare and you see, you know, some role modeling of good parenting or behaviors among the staff that work there. So there's not just like a one bullet shot. And I think definitely as a provider, again, you know, using the ACE score is not necessarily to diagnose something, but it's to help me understand where my patient's coming from and what are the resources they need to tap into. So there is and we need to treat, you know, we need to treat the asthma and we need to treat other things. But the treatment for some of these things is pretty difficult and complex.
Well, I think as a society, we have a responsibility that we recognize the problem and that we certainly, as care providers, look at our clients, patients, et cetera, not what's wrong with that mother, why is she doing these things, but what happened to her to help us understand how to better support and help her. And we have to look at all possible community relationships, because positive, supportive relationships is the answer. And we all know stories of people who have come out of difficult circumstances, you know, that have been successful. But they've been successful because somebody in that environment provided that positive relationship. And the teacher can be that person. The doctor can be that person. The neighbor can be that person. The church can be that group. So we've got to have collectively all of us understand that we have a responsibility to do a better job of taking care of pregnant ladies and their new babies and new parents. Because I think the issue with parents today is they are under significant more stress than in the days when I raised my kids, which is a long time ago, that our society has changed, the economics has changed. And then we get into what society can do from a policy perspective, and I may let Marquita answer or talk a little bit about that. I have my ideas, but there are things we can collectively do that don't fit in the traditional political discussion as being a right or left, red or blue issue.
But before we talk about the policy solutions, I did want to ask, I think maybe some of our listeners whose children have our kids first, they might be a bit concerned that these screenings and treatment options aren't covered by our kids. Is what they can still get treatment options through their insurance?
Right. I mean, I think if you have a diagnosis, you know, if you have, anxiety or depression or something like that, you know, those are things that are going to be traditionally, covered by insurance and still would, seek care. Developmental screening is not covered, but it's sort of part of that well child care that they get. It's sort of included, although some insurance companies will pay for some developmental screenings. There's no one I know of that's really paying for anything along an ACE screening. I think it's sort of part of your, like I said, sort of your social history, getting to know and understand your patients so that you can treat them appropriately.
There is a really great tool to empower parents that's available through the CDC to download on your smartphone. It's called Milestone Tracker, and it's an app you can download as a mother or father to say, here are the things your child, you put the birth date in, here are the things your child should be doing. And it's a very useful tool, because if there's red flags that come up on that script, on that monitoring, then that can be taken to the doctor and say, hey, I'm really worried about my kid's development, my kid's behavior. Here's some facts to go to the doctor with. But it's called Milestone Tracker. Just Google CDC Milestone Tracker. And it's a free app to download. It will be available in Spanish probably in the fall sometime, but it's available now in English.
And one of the really important things that I wanted to add, based on the question about families who might have Medicaid or our kids coverage and what's available to them. So one really exciting area where we've made progress actually is what treatment and services we cover for really young children. And so we worked on this for years, even before my career at Arkansas Advocates, and I worked on this with a group of folks at the Department of Human Services. But we've recently in the state created basically a list of services or a service array that Medicaid reimburses for, particularly for really young children, 0 to 46 months. Or 47 months for young children. And basically it will allow those children who are identified, of course that screening piece and identifying them is hugely important, but those children who are identified, they will be able to get those services even as really young children. A lot of that dyadic treatment that Dr. Meese was talking about.
What is dyadic?
They're next. That's always the next question. What is that? And it's the treatment that, and Dr. Meese and Chad can certainly, Dr. Rogers can talk about a little bit more, but basically means that the mother or caregiver and that child can be covered and participate in treatment. So for example, in terms of, how this is paid for and that coverage piece being hugely important, maybe mom doesn't have insurance or private insurance that will cover her at all, but that family might be eligible, or that child might be eligible for Medicaid. And so with dyadic treatment and Medicaid now reimbursing, that mom and child can participate in that treatment based on the child being at risk and identified. The state is still working on really just kind of rolling this out. They are having to do training and certification for the professionals in our state to make sure that they are well equipped to provide this. But I think that that's really exciting in terms of our state starting to put some policy components in place.
And one other thing for school-aged children is that Medicaid will cover mental health services in the school so that you don't have to take your child somewhere else to receive mental health treatment. They can, the therapist will come to them at school and it can be done at school, which is great because I know some private insurances will not pay for that. So if you're on private insurance, you would have to take your child to the therapist's office outside of the school day.
And again, just to reiterate something that Dr. Meese said earlier, in many cases, you just can't treat the child without treating the parent too. We have kids who get into developmental daycares where they have a caregiver that works with them on many of these delays or some of the social emotional issues they're having. And yet they're still going home to the same home environment, and we're not equipping our parents to continue to do that and reinforce that in the home. And really, it's not, and you could go even broader, it's not just about treating the parent, but it's about treating the family and the community. And that's where we would begin to move the needle on this.
And I would just add that's one of the important shifts in terms of those policies having to be aligned with what's appropriate and what works for these families and these children. And I really think that that there has been a broader understanding. We're beginning to see a broader understanding of the need to support the entire family unit. But, you know, there's a lot of small policy barriers sometimes that exist, like a school is not recognized as a place where you can provide service. We won't reimburse for it in a school. And so some of those types of policies, or no, we won't reimburse for treatment that includes both that parent and that child. And so it's a lot of those kind of finite rules that can oftentimes serve as a barrier. So it's really great to see kind of what works from the experts who are treating the children, that beginning to align on kind of the insurance coverage, Medicaid side.
But the exciting thing is, the good news is, we understand something we didn't understand before. And you were saying this is kind of a negative story if you emphasize trauma and adversity. But unless we understand that's part of it, and that there are really things we can do, such as dyadic or child-parent psychotherapy and reframing the whole system, if you would, the help system from DHS to ADH to the healthcare system, that's the good news. Now, does that change quickly? Unfortunately, we move slowly, but now we're moving, and that's the exciting thing.
And that brings me to ask, so all of you are on the Adverse Childhood Experiences and Resilience Work Group. What is that, and what are y'all working on, and what are the policies that you're trying to get implemented?
Okay, so the Adverse Childhood Experiences and Resilience Work Group is only about a year old. We just we had our first meeting back in May 2017. But like I said earlier, we are a cross-sector collaboration, which means that we have people from higher education and kindergarten through 12th grade education and early childhood, healthcare, mental health, public health, even the court system, and we're reaching out to law enforcement, the faith-based community, and school health and school districts and community-based organizations. And we're bringing everybody who is working with children and families and those areas where they're dealing with the effects of ACEs, such as in law enforcement, to bring everybody together to share information, to raise awareness, to help enact the systems and policy change that we've been talking about, and then also to train the people who are working on the front lines with children and families in other areas to be more what we call trauma-informed or ACEs-aware, to understand the science behind all of this and to understand how it affects behavior of individuals, how it affects, you know, their health outcomes or their job prospects or their economic status, so that they can be more aware of how to address and help prevent, but then also to make sure that we're not doing things as agencies or organizations that will re-traumatize people who are already traumatized as well. And so we're just working to bring everybody to the table and work on those broad goals. And we have a summit coming up in September 25th and 26th, and it is going to be at Camp Aldersgate, and we're going to have a couple of national keynote speakers coming in, and we're really excited about that, whose focus is on equity as well as community trauma, because a community itself can be traumatized, and we're not talking about just the total number of traumatized people within a city, but that from a historical perspective, things that happen within a city can traumatize the entire community. And so that's one of the things that we're looking at as well, is how do we address it from a holistic community standpoint.
So is that conference going to be open to community leaders and parents and teachers?
Yes, it's going to be. We've got several tracks. On Tuesday, Tuesday evening, September 25th, we're going to have an evening session just for foster and adoptive parents, early childhood classroom teachers, K-12 classroom teachers, and parents of children with special health needs. They're going to get a 2.5-hour session to take a deep dive into this and what they can do, how it affects them. And then on Wednesday, during the full day session, we have tracks for public policy, so local and state policymakers, elected officials, state agency folks, as well as a health track, which would encompass mental health, school-based health, pediatric healthcare, and what am I forgetting? Public health. And then and then we have a track for community and faith-based organizations as well.
And since there are, I mean, you have a million tracks because there's a million aspects to this, and because there are so many things that can cause adverse childhood experiences, and there's so many consequences of those adverse childhood experiences, what would y'all say are the major policies that we could push for to address these issues, or the issue of adverse childhood experience?
Well, I'll let Marquita jump in here in a second, but I think anything that supports families, number one, that's crucial. So things like poverty reduction, expanding universal pre-K, raising the minimum wage, helping parents to be prepared to find steady, gainful employment so that they can not have to deal with the stress of holding down three jobs and raising their children in order to live. Other things is expanding what we know works, such as nurse home visiting programs for infants. So there are any number of policy directions that we can go that can support increasing mental health access, increasing substance abuse treatment access. All of those things that we're already talking about in various forms and fashions here in the state are things that can help alleviate some of the conditions that are creating these adversities for children.
The only thing I would add is that we've got to move the bar earlier and earlier. The longer we wait, the longer we wait to identify an issue, the worse it is and the more intervention it requires. And so that means conception through the first 3 years of life is probably the best window. So any policy that affects pregnant women and their babies, and it can be a simple thing, like every place of business should have a sign for parking close for pregnant women. Few places do, but we don't really do a good job collectively. It could be other simple things that we can do. It doesn't necessarily mean government intervention. And the issue with a lot of these things, they become politicized. And I think what we do have to do is change our thinking and our culture. Mm-hmm. We have to look at kids as the future of that we better invest in for the good of society and the good of the future of Arkansas. And affordable, high-quality child care would be a great start. Mm-hmm. If we're going to require economically women to work, which basically they are required to do because they don't have a choice, because you can't support a family today on the full-time wage of one person. That's not doable anymore. So, and affordable is one thing, but at least it should be high quality. We don't even have available high quality for everybody, much less affordable. And many people spend maybe 30% of their income for child care, and that's under our present circumstances. And our child care workers are below minimum wage. So those are some simple things.
We'll be talking more about that in August if you want to listen to that show.
Well, so they've stolen my whole list. I have nothing to say now. No, they really touched on, a lot of those key policy opportunities. And actually what I want to do is mention a report that we've recently released at Arkansas Advocates for anyone who wants to read more about this and get a little bit more in depth. But basically that piece that Jenny mentioned about poverty reduction is really important back to that notion of supporting the entire family. And so we've recently released a report actually this week called the Health and Wealth Report. And it talks about those key connections essentially between your economic status or if you're living in poverty and how that affects your health and well-being at every single stage throughout your life and reinforces this notion that those really early investments are so critically important. Another really important issue that we highlight in this report is that we didn't get where we are today by accident. And so we also have to be intentional in putting policies in place to help us reverse the trend of where we're going. A lot of the policies that are in place today, or a lot of the environments that are people are living in and conditions that they're living in today, are because of specific policies that kind of led to certain groups of people being much more likely to live in poverty, to have poor access to healthcare, to have poor access to meaningful jobs and work. And so now we need to be intentional about undoing some of those bad policies, but also focusing on putting more effective policies in place. And so it's all of those things that were just named, things like continuing to expand access and funding for home visiting programs, ensuring everyone, the entire family, has access to affordable health care. Safe housing is a huge one, especially in Arkansas, where we are the only state without a warrant of habitability, which essentially means that a landlord can continue to collect their rent and that renter is under an obligation to pay regardless of whether the conditions in that home are safe or not. And so, you know, I think the big takeaway, again, is just that we have to be intentional about changing this trajectory and moving in the other direction of really supporting children, supporting them early on, and then thinking about ways that we can support the health and well-being of the entire family.
So we're about to move into our discussion about the new Medicaid work requirements. All of our listeners can and know what, if they do have Medicaid or know someone who has Medicaid, how they can stay compliant and keep their insurance. But for our guests discussing adverse childhood experiences, do you have any last thoughts you'd like to leave our listeners with?
I think it's very important for people to understand that when we talk about childhood adversity and trauma and the effects that they have, that we're not giving anyone a get-out-of-jail-free card. This does not absolve anyone from their personal responsibility, but I think it explains why things happen and why people behave the way they do. And what we need to take from that is that we need to intervene and correct those issues and help these people, give them that extra support and help that they need before it gets to the point where they commit a crime or they do something else that that we have to hold them responsible for. And so it's really about prevention more than anything else. It's preventing the ACEs themselves, but then if the ACEs occur, preventing those bad outcomes for the individual.
My final thoughts would be, if it's predictable, it's preventable. And what we are able to do with this new science is predict that these things happen, and therefore it is preventable. So I think we need to, we need radical transformation of many systems, including, you know, almost every system designed to help people. And I think that's the challenge we face. Yeah, but we got to start with that information, that science. And it's exciting because I look at a lot of these problems as chronic problems. I mean, poverty, my goodness, how are we going to solve that? We've been talking about this for a million years. But now we have some ways that we can look at this as a investment in the future and good stewardship. And we have to change our thinking about the collective responsibility we all have for the welfare of the baby, the pregnant woman, and the baby born today.
Okay, well, thank you all so much. If you have a question about what Marquita is about to discuss with the Medicaid work requirements, you can give us a call at 433-0088. So, Marquita, the state just is about to roll out, or they have rolled out the new Medicaid work requirements. What does that mean, and how can people make sure that they are compliant with those requirements?
Yes, so this is a pretty big deal. So Arkansas is the first state in the nation, and this is in the entire history of the Medicaid program, that a work requirement or obligation to participate in work activities has been attached to eligibility for Medicaid. We aren't the first state to actually get approval, which it has to come through the federal government to approve allowing states to do this, but we are the first state as of June 1 that's going live with this requirement. So first, just a clarification. This new work requirement in Arkansas only applies to people who are enrolled in the Arkansas Works program. Arkansas Works is the state Medicaid expansion program for low-income adults. So there are a lot of people who have private coverage. So you might be enrolled in Blue Cross, Ambetter, one of those plans, and you have little to no premium. You probably are benefiting from the Arkansas Works program. So all of the people in that program will now have to meet and be compliant with this new work requirement. If you are enrolled in the program, you should have received a couple of notices by now. The state has sent out a few notices, so those notices might have come from the Department of Human Services, but your insurance provider or carrier would have also sent you out a notice. So you might have also gotten a notice from Blue Cross, and you might have gotten a phone call. So there's been a lot of effort put into trying to reach people in various ways to make sure that they know about this new work requirement. So the actual requirement, it's for basically enrollees either have to be participating in work or an approved work activity for 80 hours per month. Or they have to meet an exemption from having to report and be compliant with the work requirement. And there's a really long list of exemptions. So for example, someone who has a dependent child would be exempt from the work requirement. Someone maybe who's already participating in work activities because they're receiving SNAP, which is the former food stamp program, they're receiving SNAP benefits. So they would be exempt from this work requirement. If you're considered medically frail, you're exempt. If you're going to school or working, if you're going to school full time, you would be exempt. But the important note to make here is even if you're exempt, you still may have to take some action. So you may have to go on to the Department of Human Services website, log into your account to be able to report or demonstrate that you meet one of those exemption categories. There's a couple of exemptions that are automatic, but that's one of the things that's really important for people to be proactive about contacting DHS or contacting their insurance carrier and getting some clarity on are they actually exempt? What do they need to do to report? Another, I think, important point to note is because you do have to meet that 80 hours per month bar. So let's say you are enrolled in school part-time. Well, you need to participate in some other activity, whether that's volunteer work, whether that's working part-time, but through some combination of activities, then you would have to meet that 80-hour per month requirement. So just please make that note. If you are not participating in some of those things full-time, you may have to do it through some combination of activities. So last week, the state only rolled this out to a portion of the population as well. And so while you might have to participate in this program this year, if you're 30 to 49 years old, you may not be a part of the group that has to start reporting in June. Again, really important if you've received a notice to open that mail, read that notice, because that's how a person would know you're in the group that has to begin complying this month, or you might get be in the next group that has to enroll and participate in this program. And so I know we've talked about this in a lot more detail a few months back. And so the big message here is that it is here, it's happening, and we want to make sure that people are aware and can comply. Because the good news is that the great majority of people in the Arkansas Works program will meet an exemption or they are already working. But we don't want folks to fall through the cracks in the advocacy community. That's our biggest concern, is that people are going to fall through the cracks, not because they don't meet the work requirement, but because they don't have internet access. Maybe they had an address change, they didn't know. Maybe they have some other barriers, like maybe you are caring for a sick relative or you're sick yourself and it's just not a high priority. Those are all understandable issues, but it's really important right now to be proactive about that so that you don't lose your coverage.
And so how do people report their 80 hours?
Sure. So it will primarily happen through this electronic portal. And so, again, that's why it's really important to visit the website that DHS has set up and go in and be able to link it to your existing health account. They have lots of helpful videos that walk people through how to do that. They also have a number you can call, and someone will walk you through what you need to do. And I would say even if you haven't received a notice, but you think this might apply to you because you know you're enrolled in Arkansas Works, it is better to go ahead and call or go ahead and go onto that website and try and figure out what you need to do, because it's possible that you are exempt, or it's possible that you might not have to start reporting this month, but you might be in the batch that has to the next month. So if you have any concerns about how this will impact you, or if it should, or if you should be reporting, I would take advantage of that now, because the risk here is potentially losing coverage. If a person fails to report, you get two times, and on that third time, you will be unenrolled from the program for the remainder of the year. And so it's really critical. And unless that person qualifies for a different category of Medicaid, they wouldn't be able to re-enroll even if they came into compliance later. So really, really important.
So if you don't have internet access, is there an alternative way that you can report, or do you have to report online?
Well, and that's why I said it's really important too to call and to find out. And so they can also go to their county office. If you have a local county office near you, you can also go to the county office and they'll help you. And then I know that there is just lots of community organizations and groups out in your community that I know are trying to prepare to be able to help people walk through these requirements. And so it's a really new way of doing things. Again, we've advocated against this, not because we are not supportive of people being able to have the support and resources they need to get the job training, to connect to meaningful employment opportunities, but we have some concerns about people falling through the cracks and losing coverage. I think the best thing we can do right now is just educate people about the requirement and make sure that they don't fall victim to just forgetting to report and they lose their coverage. One other group that I want to highlight that's available as a resource, Legal Aid of Arkansas. They have always had and still have a Medicaid assistance line. And so if someone has questions or needs help, or they lose coverage and they're not sure if that was, if they should have, was it fair, and they just need some additional assistance, they can always contact Legal Aid of Arkansas. Their number is 1-800-967-9224. Again, Legal Aid of Arkansas, it's 1-800-967-9224. But your first point of contact should be DHS, just to make sure you get your account and everything set up. Should you need some additional assistance, Legal Aid would also be happy to help folks.
And when will this fully be rolled out?
So they are, the state is slowly rolling it out. And so this year it will only be rolled out to 30 to 49 year olds. And then those younger enrollees, 19 to 29, will be added to the program in 2019. And so this year it's only affecting those people who are in that 30 to 49 year old population. And so I think the other really good thing about that is that it gives us an opportunity to provide feedback to the state if people are having trouble complying or with the IT system. We can kind of hopefully give that feedback and get those things fixed early.
Well, thank you all for listening. And like Marquita said, if you have Medicaid, please make sure that you check your mail to make sure that you get your notices and stay compliant and keep your insurance. Thank you all so much for listening.
We are 100,000 watts of community radio here in Central Arkansas. This is KABF 88.3 Little Rock, the voice of the people.
This is Wade Brasky with the Chief Organizer's Report. Minors entering real property under false pretenses with intent to commit a felony, not a break-in. Answer: when James O'Keefe cops a plea and then whines about it. Oh, mercy. I've done it now. I've hurt the far-right-wing video scammer James O'Keefe's feelings. I used the common catch-all description, break-in, for O'Keefe and his crew's escapade when they were caught.